Good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West, the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is September the 15th. 258th day of the year. 107 days remain until this year is over with. On this day in history in 994 A.D., there was a major Fatimid victory over the Byzantine Empire at the Battle of Orontes. In 1440, something I find fascinating, Giles de Reyes, one of the earliest known serial killers, is taken into custody on an accusation brought against him by Jean de Malestroy. Okay, I hate it when folks play phone games in another language. Well, accusations brought against him by Jean de Malestroy, the Bishop of Nantes. Giles de Reyes was actually a very powerful noble. Now, his birth date's not known. However, he was a knight and lord from Brittany, Anjou, and Poitiers. A leader in the French army, he was a companion of Joan of Arc. But he's best known for his conviction as a confessed serial killer of children. He was a member of the House of Montmorency Laval, grew up under the tutelage of his maternal grandfather, and increased his fortune by marriage. And he earned the favor of the Duke of Brittany and was admitted to the French court. Now, from 1427 to 1435, he was a commander in the French army. Fought alongside Joan of Arc against the English and their Burgundian allies during the Hundred Years' War, and was appointed a Marshal of France. Well, from 1434, he retired from military life and began to deplete his vast wealth by staging an extravagant theatrical spectacle of his own composition. Was even accused of dabbling in the occult. After 1432, was accused of engaging in a series of child murders with victims possibly numbering in the hundreds. Killings came to an end in 1440 when a violent dispute with a clergyman led to an ecclesiastical investigation that actually brought his crimes to light. At his trial, the parents of missing children in the surrounding area and his own confederates in crime testified against him. He was condemned to death and hung at Nantes on October 26, 1440. He was believed to be the inspiration for the French folktale Bluebeard, which is recorded at its earliest in 1697. But even the power of the nobility couldn't protect him, which was highly unusual for those days. 1530, the appearance of the miraculous portrait of St. Dominic in Soriano Calabro in Calabria, Italy, commemorated as a feast day by the Roman Catholic Church and up until 1912. 1556, departing from Vicingen, ex-Holy Roman Emperor Charles V returned to Spain. He was all-powerful. The emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, which was neither holy nor Roman, nor by that time really an empire. 1762, the Seven Years' War, the Battle of Signal Hill. As the last battle of the North American theater of the Seven Years' War, British force under Lieutenant Colonel William Amherst recaptured St. John's, which the French had seized earlier that year in a surprise attack. Well, for 7 years, the two greatest powers in the world hammered away at each other and all over the world. 1776, American Revolutionary War. British forces land at Kips Bay during the New York campaign. 1789, U.S. Department of Foreign Affairs, established by law in July of that year, renamed the Department of State and given a variety of domestic duties. 1794, French Revolutionary War. Arthur Wellesley, later known as the Duke of Wellington, sees his first combat at the Battle of Box Tell during the Flanders campaign. 1795, Britain seizes the Dutch Cape Colony in South Africa to prevent its use by the Batavian Republic. 1812, the Grand Army under Napoleon reaches the Kremlin in Moscow. Also in 1812, the War of 1812, with a second supply train sent to relieve Fort Harrison, is ambushed in the attack at the Narrows. Now, for those that are not read up on your War of 1812 history, Fort Harrison was a War of 1812 stockade constructed in 1811 on high ground overlooking Wabash River on a portion of what's today known as the modern city of Terre Haute, Indiana. It was built by forces under the command of General William Henry Harrison, staging point for Harrison to encamp his forces just prior to the Battle of Tippecanoe, which took place a month later. And the fort was the site of a famous battle in the War of 1812. That was the first significant victory for the U.S. in the war. Well, as the frontier moved west in 1818, that fort was abandoned. Now, a little relief army was sent to help Fort Harrison lift the siege. But following that relief army was a party of 13 soldiers under Lieutenant Fairbanks of the 7th Infantry. And they were escorting a supply train, a supply wagon, loaded with flour and meat. Well, on September 13th, that supply wagon was ambushed by a Potawatomi war party at a section of the trail known as the Narrows. When the ambush was launched, the draft horses panicked and ran away with the wagon. Only two men, the wagoneer John Black and Private Edward Perdue, managed to get back to Fort Knox alive, although Perdue was later discharged due to the severe wounds he received. Now, lucky for the two survivors, the Potawatomi gave chase to the runaway supply wagon. 11 soldiers and all the provisions were lost, and several Potawatomi soldiers were killed or wounded. Well, a second column of two supply wagons and 15 soldiers under Lieutenant Richardson set out from Vincennes 2 days after the first wagon. Followed the same trail, apparently unaware of the fate of the first. When the Potawatomi learned that a second supply train was approaching, they set up that same ambush at the same location. On September 15th, after the initial attack, Richardson realized he was outmanned, outgunned, and ordered to retreat. The wagons were left behind to be plundered, which may have saved the lives of the retreating soldiers. Even so, the 15 men under his command, 7 were killed and another had been badly wounded. A battalion under Major McGarry discovered the bodies a few days later and proceeded to Fort Harrison to inform Colonel Russell of the attacks and, more importantly, to the half-starved survivors at Fort Harrison, the missing supply wagons. Well, the Potawatomi party left the Narrows and attacked the house of a Southerner named Isaac Hudson on September 16th in what became known as the Lamont Prairie Massacre. Now, Hudson was away, but his wife and 4 children were there, and they were killed. Well, the Battle of Fort Harrison was considered, as I said, the first land victory of the U.S. during the War of 1812. That same day, General Harrison's forces relieved Fort Wayne, which eliminated the last Indian threat to Indiana Territory for the remainder of the war. All righty. 1816, the HMS Whiting runs aground on the Doom Bar. 1820, Constitutionalist Revolution in Lisbon, Portugal. 1821, the Captaincy General of Guatemala declares independence from Spain. 1830, the Liverpool to Manchester Railway line opens up. British MP William Huskisson becomes the first widely reported railway passenger fatality when he's struck and killed by the locomotive, the Rocket. 1835, HMS Beagle with Charles Darwin on board reaches the Galapagos Islands. Ship lands at Chatham, or San Cristobal, the easternmost of the archipelago. 1862, American Civil War. Confederate forces capture Harper's Ferry, Virginia. It's present-day Harper's Ferry, West Virginia. There was a big arsenal there. 1873, Franco-Prussian War. The last Imperial German Army troops leave France upon completion of the payment of the indemnity they were owed because of World War I. 1894, first Sino-Japanese War. Japan defeats the Qing Dynasty China in the Battle of Pyongyang. 1915, the Empire Picture Theatre, now the New Empire Cinema, the oldest running cinema in mainland Australia, opens in Balmoral in New South Wales. 1915, the New Culture Movement. Chen Duxiu establishes the New Youth magazine in Shanghai. 1916, World War I. Tanks are used for the first time in battle at the Battle of the Somme. 1918, World War I. Allied troops break through the Bulgarian defenses on the Macedonian front. 1935, the Nuremberg Laws deprive German Jews of their citizenship. 1935, New Germany adopts a new national flag bearing the swastika. 1940, World War II. The climax of the Battle of Britain when the Luftwaffe launches the largest, most concentrated attack of the entire campaign. Had Britain fallen, history would have been much different than it is. Or was. 1942, World War II. U.S. Navy aircraft carrier USS Wasp is sunk by the Japanese torpedoes at Guadalcanal. 1944, Franklin Roosevelt and Winston Churchill meet in Quebec as part of the Octagon Conference to discuss strategy. 1944, Battle of Peleliu begins as the U.S. Marine Corps' 1st Marine Division and the U.S. Army's 81st Infantry Division hit White and Orange beaches under heavy fire from Japanese infantry and artillery. 1945, a hurricane strikes southern Florida and the Bahamas, destroys 366 airplanes and 25 blimps at Naval Air Station Richmond. 1947, Typhoon Kathleen hits the Kanto region in Japan, kills over 1,000 people. 1948, the Indian Army captures the town of Yana, Latur, Aminabad, Suryapet, and Akatpali as part of the Operation Polo. 1948, the F-86 Sabre sets the world aircraft speed record at 671 miles an hour. 1950, the Korean War. The U.S. 10th Corps lands at Incheon. 1952, United Nations cedes Eritrea to Ethiopia. 1958, Central Railroad of New Jersey commuter train runs to an open drawbridge at the Newark Bay. 48 people die. 1959, Nikita Khrushchev becomes the first Soviet leader to visit the United States. 1962, the Soviet ship Poltava heads toward Cuba. One of the events that set in motion the Cuban Missile Crisis. 1963, Baptist church bombing. 4 children killed in the bombing of an African-American church in Birmingham, Alabama. 1967, President Lyndon, I'm going to be King Johnson, responding to a sniper attack at the University of Texas in Austin, writes a letter to Congress urging the enactment of gun control legislation. Every single president, primarily the Democrats, have wanted to disarm the country. You got to wonder why. 1968, the Soviet Zond 5 spaceship is launched, becomes the first spacecraft to fly around the moon or enter the Earth's atmosphere. 1971, the first Greenpeace ship departs Vancouver to protest against the upcoming Kanakan nuclear weapons test in Alaska. 1972, a Scandinavian Airlines system domestic flight from Gothenburg to Stockholm is hijacked and flown to Malmö, Butofta Airport. 1974, Air Vietnam Flight 706 is hijacked and then crashes while attempting to land with 75 people on board. 1975, the French Department of Corse, the entire island of Corsica is divided into two, Haute Corse, Upper Corsica, and Corse du Sud, Southern Corsica. 1978, Muhammad Ali outpointed Leon Spinks in a rematch to become the first boxer to win the world heavyweight title 3 times at the Superdome in New Orleans. 1981, the Senate Judiciary Committee unanimously approved Sandra Day O'Connor becomes the first female justice of the Supreme Court of the United States. And let me say, from my experiences in dealing with her, if you didn't know somebody, she wasn't going to look at what you sent. 1981, John Bull becomes the oldest operable steam locomotive in the world when the Smithsonian Institute operates it under its own power outside Washington, D.C. 1983, Israeli Premier Menachem Begin resigns. 2000, the Summer Olympics, officially known as the Games of the 27th Olympiad, are open in Sydney, Australia. 2004, National Hockey League Commissioner Gary Bettman announces lockout of the Players' Union and cessation of operations by the National Hockey League head office. 2008, Lehman Brothers files for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, the largest bankruptcy filing in U.S. history. 2017, the Parsons Green bombing takes place in London. 2020, signing of the Bahrain-Israeli normalization agreement occurs in Washington, D.C. Normalized relations between Israel and two Arab nations, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. Well, there's a lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Far too many to go into, and most of them won't have any meaning anyway. In the UK, it's Battle of Britain Day. Christian Feast Day, Joseph Abibos, Alpinus of Lyon, Arpress of Toul, Catherine of Genoa, John Chisholm in the Episcopal Church, St. Dominic in Soriano. Mamilian of Palermo, Mirren, Nicetas of the Goth, Nicodemus, Our Lady of Sorrows, Cry of Dolores, celebrated on the eve of Independence Day in Mexico. The Cry of Dolores occurred in Dolores, Mexico, when Roman Catholic priest Miguel Hidalgo y Costillo rang his church bell and gave the call to arms that triggered the Mexican War of Independence. And every year on the eve of Independence Day, the president of Mexico reenacts the cry from the balcony of the National Palace of Mexico City. And he rings the same bell Hidalgo used in 1810. And while patriotism has become passé here with all our brilliant students who grew up in their mother's basement, there's still patriotism in Mexico. Earliest day in which Father's Day can fall, September 21st is the latest, celebrated on the third Sunday in September in Ukraine. It's also the earliest day in which German-American Steuben Parade can fall, September 21st is the latest, celebrated on the third Sunday in September in the U.S., especially New York City, though I'm not so sure about today. Earliest day in which POW-MIA Recognition Day can fall, September 21st is the latest, celebrated on the third Friday in September in the U.S., earliest day in which Prince Jesdag can fall, September 21st is the latest, celebrated on the third Tuesday in September in the Netherlands. Earliest day in which Respect for the Aged Day can fall, while September 21st is the latest. In Japan, it's celebrated on the third Monday in September. It's Engineers Day in India. Independence Day, which celebrates the independence from Spain in 1821 of Guatemala, El Salvador and Honduras, Nicaragua and Costa Rica. International Day of Democracy, Knowledge Day in Azerbaijan, Restoration of Primorska to the Motherland Day in Slovenia, Silpa Bharasi Day in Thailand, the beginning of German-American Heritage Month. It's celebrated until October 15th. The beginning of National Hispanic Heritage Month, celebrated in the U.S. until October 15th. And internationally, it's World Lymphoma Awareness Day. And let's see what else we got. In 1616, the first non-aristocratic free public school in Europe is open in Frascati, Italy. In 1928, Scottish bacteriologist Alexander Fleming discovers penicillin while studying influenza. In 1940, I said it was the Battle of Britain Day. It's the end of the Battle of Britain. The tide began to turn as Royal Air Force threw back a major Luftwaffe attack. Royal Air Force lost 29 to the Germans 61. 1992, George Soros' quantum fund begins selling large amounts of pound sterling. He's labeled the man that broke the Bank of England when the pound crashes the next day. Well, '608, St. Boniface IV begins his reign as Catholic Pope. 668, Eastern Roman Emperor Constans II is assassinated in his bath at Syracuse, Italy. 921, St. Ludmilla is murdered at the command of her daughter-in-law at Teton. 1584, San Lorenzo del Escorial Palace in Madrid is finished. And in 1590, Giam Battista Cotogna, erected as Pope Urban VII. '1683, Germantown in Pennsylvania is founded by 13 immigrant families. 1777, George Washington, on authorization of Congress, appoints Casimir Pulaski, Brigadier General in the Continental Army Cavalry. It all comes down to who you know, don't you know? Well, that ends our history session. We've been talking about a lot of things over the last few shows. You know, one thing that I always like to talk about is when I get new information on Roswell. Now, I've written books that have sold extremely well there. I spoke there for 10 years on during the July 4th events until Don Smith decided I was not politically acceptable because I didn't recognize his brilliance. Well, some things that have recently come to light is Jesse Marcel's journal. And many believe it may hold the key to Roswell's secrets. The only problem, it's written in a secret code only the Army Major knew. Now, according to the story, in July of 1947, a strange silvery object crashed into the desert sands near Roswell Army Air Force Base in New Mexico. Mac Brazil, the rancher who discovered the debris field, okay, as I was saying, Mac Brazil called the sheriff, who called the military, and the military sent Major Jesse Marcel, the intelligence officer for Roswell Army Air Field in New Mexico, to oversee the collection of the debris. On July 8th, the Army released a statement saying Marcel's men found pieces of a flying disc, leading many to believe an alien spaceship had crashed to Earth. Front page of the Roswell Daily Record said the RAAF, Roswell Army Airfield, captures a flying saucer. But the very next day, the Army sent out a new statement saying the searchers actually found shredded pieces of a weather balloon. When in doubt, lie. The clarification didn't stop the rumors of a UFO crash. If anything, it only fueled the belief that not only had our planet gotten visitors from outer space, the government was now trying to cover it up. Well, for the rest of his life, Jesse Marcel maintained he had accurately reported what he found. Most peculiarly, a small metal beam imprinted with strange purple hieroglyphics. But he wasn't allowed to talk about what he had found. According to his daughter, Linda Marcel, in an interview with the Associated Press after the major died in 2013 at the age of 76, they were told by their superiors to keep it all quiet. And they all did for years. Well, now his family's revealed that Marcel kept a diary during the time of the recovery operation and its aftermath that speaks to what he called the indestructible debris that wasn't made by human hands. The journal contains what appears to be coded passages by the intelligence officers are still being examined and unraveled. Marcel's family believes when this is decoded, so to speak, it'll shed new light on the UFO crash and exonerate their father. According to Jesse Marcel III, the grandson, he was made to be the fall guy. He was the head of intelligence in Roswell, New Mexico, and just followed orders. In essence, he was at the heart of the story and the heart of the conspiracy of the cover-up. Well, the story faded from memory for over 30 years until interest in UFOs surged in the 70s, and the Roswell incident was re-examined in books, TV shows, and movies. In 1980, Marcel told the popular series In Search Of that he had been pressured to toe the official military line about the weather balloon to keep my mouth shut. It wasn't until the 1990s the government launched an official internal investigation into the matter and concluded that there was a cover-up, though it didn't deal with aliens. The military determined the debris likely was linked to a top-secret program called Project Mogul that sent up high-altitude balloons affixed with microphones to pick up long-distance sound waves from Soviet atomic bomb tests. Now, Marcel's family dismisses that, says that Marcel brought home some debris that included fiber optics from what he thought came from an onboard computer, and an unusual marking of what looked like a symbol of a seal balancing a ball on its nose. According to his grandson, his grandfather told him he might be the first person on Earth to look at alien writing. Well, part and parcel with whatever landed at Roswell, we have the inimitable Area 51. Now, ever since President Eisenhower established a dry lake bed in the Nevada desert at a top secret site, speculation has swirled over what's going on there. Named after the Atomic Energy Commission's grid number system on a map, Area 51 has been identified by conspiracy theorists as ground zero for experiments on UFOs and aliens. That's where they staged the moon landing and the headquarters for the cover-up of the Roswell crash. Now, in 2017, the Pentagon confirmed spending $22 million on a program to analyze anomalous aerospace threats, including reported close encounters with UFOs. This, of course, reignited speculation. In reality, the site has probably been used to test experimental spy planes and the stealth spider, which would account for the lights, but it wouldn't account for all the anomalies. Well, you know, long before Roswell, there were people in this country reporting seeing enigmatic airships. For example, one night in November 1896, Colonel Henry Glenville Shaw and his young companion, Camille Spooner, were taking a buggy ride toward Lodi, California. Suddenly, as they rode along, their horse stopped and snorted in terror. According to Civil War veteran Shaw, "We looked up and saw three strange beings." He gave an interview to the Stockton Evening Mail. He once edited that paper. He said they resembled humans in many respects, but still they weren't like anything I'd ever seen. They were nearly 7 feet high and very slender. Now, this was the first in a series of press accounts in the 1880s and 1890s of what at the time was called the mystery airships that was seen all over the world, but making peculiarly dramatic appearance in the American West. The Sacramento Bee and the San Francisco Call, two newspapers, also quoted witnesses describing a dark metallic shape that hovered 1,000 feet in the air. Some observers claimed the beings powered the craft by pedaling while singing as they worked. Odd. Now, Shaw was the most vivid account. He described the beings as possessed of a strange and indescribable beauty, and they were covered with an unusual natural growth and had small ears, bald heads, and tiny mouths, large and lustrous eyes and noses with the appearance of polished ivory. Well, Shaw got close enough to ask the creatures where they were from, and they didn't seem to understand him. And it began to warble, as he called it, back at him. Stories followed over the next few months by similar articles in newspapers in Arkansas, Nebraska, Missouri, Kansas, and Texas. Reports ended as quickly as they arrived, as interest in outer space creatures seemed to wane. Now, researchers have no explanation for the sudden wave of airship sightings, other than that newspapers in the yellow journalism era had no hesitancy about printing sensational, uncooperative reports to sell papers. It's always annoying when people do not understand. No. Well, you know, one area there's been a lot of discussion about is the area of Marfa, Texas. I've done a number of appearances there. And the mysterious aerial display was first recorded in the 1800s, and it's talked about all over Texas. In fact, the lights that were seen were originally thought to be the campfires of Indian raiding parties. And then during World War II, it was decided that they were the campfires of spies sneaking into the country. So in order to be able to find those locations in the daylight, they had planes go up with bags of flour to bomb what were thought to be the campfires. The first report was 1883 when a young cowhand named Robert Reed Ellison was driving cattle through Pisano Pass in West Texas. He spotted a flickering light in the distance, and he was positive it was an Apache campfire. When he rode to the source, he found no signs that Native Americans had even been there at all. So his account was the first documented sighting of what would become known as the Marfa Lights. Dazzling displays of bouncing yellow orbs, streaks of blue, zigzagging pinks and yellows over the Chianti Mountains outside of Marfa. Marfa is now known as an artist colony. And according to local legend, the lights are the restless spirit of Apache Chief Alaste, who was executed by federal Mexican police in the 1860s. Others swear the lights come from UFOs, paranormal activity, and even witches learning how to fly their brooms. I've never seen a broom with headlights. Scientists believe it could be anything from swamp gas, that's the government's favorite explanation for unexplained lights, to electrostatic discharges. Leading theories of lights are caused by mirage-like phenomena produced when cold and warm layers of air bend light waves in a way that can't be seen from afar but not up close. Now, people can decide for themselves that a Texas Department of Transportation-built site called the Marfa Mystery Light Viewing Center, that's on U.S. Highway 90, a few miles east of town where the local celebrities go to celebrate their light show. City's website describes the lights as whimsical and friendly at best and at their worst, distant and aloof. They invite visitors to the annual Marfa Lights Festival, which features food and a parade. And those sites where you can go to watch the lights are very well constructed benches and places where you can actually go and have a picnic. Well, turning from the Marfa Lights, let's go to one of my favorite mysteries, the Bermuda Triangle. There's a search on for a craft that disappeared in December 2020, which added to the mysterious reputation of this unusual region of ocean. Well, somewhere in the waters between the Bahamas and South Florida, a 29-foot boat carrying 20 people vanished in December 2020. After an 84-hour search over some 17,000 square miles, rescuers gave up. Coast Guard Captain Stephen Burdian of the 7th District said in a statement, our thoughts and prayers go out to the families of the missing people. Now, the mysterious disappearance was the latest strange phenomenon to occur in the infamous Bermuda Triangle. That's an area of the Atlantic Ocean bounded by Miami, Bermuda, and Puerto Rico. Dozens of planes and ships have reportedly been swallowed whole, often disappearing in good weather without so much as an SOS call. The most famous case, a squadron of five military bombers were on a routine training mission off the coast of Florida in December 1945. The patrol leader became convinced that both his compasses were broken and, admittedly disoriented, he led the squad, known as Flight 19, to places unknown. Search plane went out, and that search plane was basically a flying gas tank. It was sent out to find the missing airmen and, if necessary, refuel them en route. An official investigation into what happened to Flight 19 failed to determine a plausible explanation. One military official made the comment it was as if the planes flew off to Mars. Now, some have blamed the events on extraterrestrials. Others said sea serpents, time warps, and gases bubbling up from the ocean floor, magnetic anomalies, and ghosts. Scientists in their ivory towers point instead to storms, pilot error, and mechanical breakdown. Yes, all five of Flight 19 had mechanical problems at the identical time. U.S. Navy and U.S. Coast Guard contend that there are no supernatural explanations for the disasters at sea, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Instead, they insist in an official statement that experience suggests the combined forces of nature and human fallibility outdo even the most incredulous science fiction. But that still don't give an answer as to what happened. Then we have the Bermuda Triangle of Romania, which has a reputation for paranormal activity. Not far from Transylvania, with its wandering vampires, a young girl wandered into a forest of oak trees and didn't come out. Search failed to find any trace of her, and she was given up for dead. 5 years later, she came wandering out of the forest, unharmed, but with no memory of what happened or where she'd been all that time. Now, that's one of the many legends surrounding Romania's Hoia Baciu Forest, also known as Bermuda Triangle of Romania. It's a dark stand of crooked trees, considered by some a gateway into another dimension. It's a place where paranormal activity pulsates, causing spinning compasses and flashing lights, and leaves visitors with a sudden anxiety and the sensation of their skin burning. Legend tells about ghosts hiding among the trees, of the sounds of giggling women and screaming girls, and the galloping hooves of invisible horses and deer. The gnarled and spiraling trees gave way to a clearing known as the Dead Zone. It's an almost perfect circle with nothing will grow, even though tests on the samples have found that the dirt is perfectly fine. And one of the most famous and best documented events occurred in the summer of 1968 when a man named Emile Bernayou went into the forest with his girlfriend and two friends for a picnic. Suddenly, they spotted a shimmering saucer hovering over the treetops. And just before the object vanished, Borneo, a construction engineer and former Army officer, had the presence of mind to snap a photograph. Well, the black-and-white snapshot saw what appears to be a metallic disc dangling above, angling toward the sky. So UFO enthusiasts now cite this area as the, and that photo is the best evidence of a real close encounter, which makes the forest a popular spot for curiosity seekers around the world. In fact, the bravest of them will even camp there, hoping for another close encounter, and hoping that they come back. Well, let's talk about CIA officers' tips on investigating UFOs. You know, if all the reports of UFOs, the one by Lonnie Zamora in 1964, got immediate credibility because he was, in fact, an experienced police officer. He said one night in April, while he was chasing a car outside Socorro, New Mexico, he spotted an egg-shaped, flame-shooting UFO, which landed near his patrol car. Two figures lingered outside the ship before they re-entered, and the craft flew off, leaving behind charred brush. Now, skeptics, of course, suggest the sighting could have been an elaborate hoax by high schoolers or even local political figures looking to boost tourism. The latest chief officer of the Air Force's UFO investigating program, Project Blue Book, called the Zamora account the best documented case on record, although it's still officially listed as unresolved, and one the CIA says is instrumental to study for lessons in looking into such reports. On the CIA's official website, there's an article titled How to Investigate a Flying Saucer. And in it, the AG lists 10 tips that include setting up clear objectives, consulting with experts, creating a reporting system to organize incoming cases, eliminating all the known and probable causes to leave only the few unexplained cases, and gathering and testing physical and forensic evidence. In other words, the CIA is saying, take the report seriously. Now, this may seem counterintuitive for a government agency, but as the CIA article says, while most government officials and scientists now dismiss flying saucer reports as a quaint relic of the 50s and 60s, there's still a lot to be learned from the history and methodology of flying saucer intelligence. It does raise quite a number of questions. Well, let's talk about a Navy pilot that filmed an object that defied physics. This was an object with no obvious propulsion that was captured by a jet fighter's infrared camera. Now, in this particular instance, radar picked up the objects first. Bizarre objects in groups of 5 to 10 flying in no particular flight path at about 138 miles per hour off the San Diego coast. This took place on November 10th, 2004 at an altitude of about 28,000 feet. They weren't drones. The craft was moving too slow to be planes, too high to be birds. Radar operators were so perplexed they shut down their electronic systems searching for glitches known as ghost tracks, but determined after diagnostics everything was working fine. After a Navy pilot reported seeing the vessels on a training flight, Chad Underwood took to the skies in his FA-18 Super Hornet for a closer look. When he landed back on the aircraft carrier USS Nimitz, he played a recording from an infrared camera on the left wing of his jet. It showed a 40-foot-long flying object Underwood called the Tic Tac for its oblong shape. That object flew at 24,000 feet, but didn't exhibit an exhaust trail or any other sign of propulsion. It was just zipping along. Underwood told New York Magazine in 2019, it's just what we call a UFO. That video that he shot had been leaked to the public, so of course he was interviewed. He said, I couldn't identify it. It was flying, and it was an object. Simple as that. He wasn't really prepared to call it an alien spacecraft. He simply didn't know what it was. He said the part that drew our attention was how it wasn't behaving within the normal laws of physics. What was also intriguing to him was his superiors didn't want to talk about it. He never received the expected high-level debriefing. He said, I've got top-secret clearance with a ton of special project clearances, so it's not like I wasn't cleared to know what was going on. Clearly, whatever it was, if it was a government project, I didn't need to know. Well, you know, sometimes those who have encounters with UFOs have long-lasting effects. Sometimes physical, sometimes result of the actions of our own government. How about Corey Landrum from a 1980 incident? He claims he lives under constant threat to stay quiet or else. Now, he was 7 years old at the time of what became known as the Cash Landrum incident. And events are traumatic that for most of his life, he didn't want to talk about it publicly. It took place on the night of December 29, 1980. He was getting a ride home in Piney Woods, Texas, with his grandmother, Victor Landrum, and her friend, Betty Cash, when they saw what they thought were lights from an airplane. Terrified, Colby stayed in the car, and the others got out to watch the object approach. Mesmerized, they gazed at a giant, diamond-shaped spaceship that shot flames so intense it made the car's metal body too hard to touch. Using her coat to protect her hands, Cash turned the handle to get back inside the car. And it was so hot, the vinyl on the dashboard had become soft. She actually pressed her hand into it, leaving an imprint. As the object hovered over the trees, a squadron of 23 helicopters swooped toward it, chasing it away. She later identified the helicopters as U.S. Army Chinooks. When the three got home, they experienced burning to the eyes and skin, along with vomiting and diarrhea. Cash later suffered from breast cancer she blamed on the UFO encounter. Took legal action against the government, but a military investigation found no Army helicopters were in the area that night. And for much of his life, Colby stayed out of the spotlight till 2013 when he opened up for the first time in detail to podcast UFO, expressing frustration at the government's repeated denials. Even his representatives visited him and his grandmother. He said, I can remember them coming out to the house a number of times. They'd come out and test us for radiation every so often. And I was told to be careful because somebody could scoop me up and take me away if I opened my mouth. Now, that's something nice to tell a 7-year-old boy. Well, you know, in spite of rumors to the contrary, pilots are still reporting encounters with UFOs. You know, during a flight from Cincinnati to Phoenix, the pilot of the American Airlines Airbus A320 called air traffic control shortly after noon on February 21st, 2021. He had an unusual question. He asked the air traffic control, do you have any targets up here? We just had something go right over the top of us, he asked the controller. And I hate to say this, but it looked like a long cylindrical object, almost like a cruise missile type of thing, moving really fast right over the top of us. Well, the flight transmission from Flight 2292 was intercepted off a scanner by the aviation and space news blog Deep Black Horizon, which said that at the time the American Airlines plane was at about 37,000 feet over New Mexico in an area with no significant military aircraft presence. Now, the blog, unfortunately, did not pick up the reply from the control tower of the transmissions walked over it, but the airline confirmed the authenticity of the radio call. According to the company, following a debrief with our flight crew and additional information received, we can confirm the radio transmission was from American Airlines Flight 2292 on February 21st. They advised the press to contact the FBI for more information. The FAA also confirmed the transmission, but said in a statement, FAA air traffic controllers didn't see any object in the area on their radar scopes. Well, Flight 2292 landed safely in Phoenix with whatever the pilot saw, still a mystery. The FBI spokesman told the website TMZ only that the agency was aware of the reported incident, but had no other information to give. He also added, while our policies to neither confirm nor deny investigations, the FBI works continuously with our federal, state, local, and tribal partners to share intelligence and protect the public, unless it involves somebody prominent, in which case they run the other way with their tails between their dark-suited legs. Well, from aliens, let's talk about unexplained creatures. How about the Loch Ness Monster? It's apparently resurfaced. The legendary Loch Ness Monster is reported to have been spotted at least five times recently in the dark waters of the lake in the Scottish Highlands. And in June of 2020, he made an appearance that may have been captured on a 10-minute video. Now, according to Catelyn Wangle, narrating a webcam video from Urquhart Bay of what she said was Nessie, said it moved closer to the shore. It constantly changes shape and splashes about, and it's not a boat. It just shows up in the middle of the loch, and it appears to be quite large. The object changes shape and goes into the water and comes back up again. Well, accounts about Nessie, as the locals call her, first appeared in a 6th century biography of an Irish monk who was mauled by a water beast. He survived only by flashing the sign of the cross. Now, that's been used as the excuse for many, many people getting away from many, many creatures. But it was during the 1930s, after the completion of a road to this once isolated location, that the Loch Ness Monster became a media phenomenon. There were new sightings in the 750-foot deep loch, and its first purported photos surfaced. The most famous picture is a blurry snapshot taken in 1934 of what looks like a long-necked animal sticking its head above the water. Now, although the photos have largely been dismissed as a hoax by a retired scientist, people continue to claim they've seen Nessie, and speculation swirls over what exactly this creature might be. Some say it's a massive shark, a mutant catfish, or a descendant of the long-extinct plesiosaurs of the Triassic era, which was 200 million years ago. Recently, a search for Nessie's gone high-tech, and DNA sampling from the waters of the lake have suggested another possibility, that the Loch Ness Monster might be an eel. Now, according to Professor Neil Gemmell of New Zealand's University of Otago, there's a very significant amount of eel DNA in the water. Eels are plentiful at Loch Ness, with eel DNA found in pretty much every location sampled. So, could these be giant eels? Data doesn't reveal their size, but the sheer quantity of material says we can't discount the possibility that there may be giant eels at Loch Ness. Now, how one would stand up on its tail so its head sticks up out of the water is anybody's guess, but some say Nessie may have relatives. American businessman is offering a $50,000 reward to anybody can prove that a cousin of Nessie is real after he claims he spotted the monster during a paddlewheel boat voyage on Lake Pepin, bordered by Wisconsin and Minnesota. All of a sudden, I saw a big wake out there against the current. Larry Nielsen is his name, and he told the Daily Yonder website in May of 2021 about his incident. He said it was about 100 feet long and a foot and a half wide high. I started doing some research, and that's when I heard about Pepe. Well, as for Pepe's Scottish cousin, Nessie, the sighting keep coming. Over 1,000 honest and sober people have seen monsters in Loch Ness, according to Nessie hunter Steve Feldham. All of them recorded by the official Loch Ness Monster Register. But like so much of the purported evidence of the Loch Ness Monster, the 2020 video is open interpretation. It shows not a full-fledged serpent frolicking the loch, but a black dot that appears and disappears under the waves. But Wangle says this one stands out. Why is this sighting super epic, you ask? Well, the object surfaces for more than 7 minutes. And as long as there have been sailors, there have been sea monsters. A large octopus-like creature of Scandinavian folklore known as the Kraken has been reported by ship's crews since the late 18th century and been featured in such books as Moby Dick and the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. The corpse of the dinosaur-looking Strunsay beast of the Orkney Islands off Scotland was said to have washed ashore after a storm in 1808. Now, some ivory tower scientists who didn't go see it themselves say it was probably just a decomposing shark. And in 1848, seamen aboard the HMS Daedalus spotted what they called a 60-foot-long sea serpent off the coast of modern-day Namibia. Gave one quite the idea of a large snake or eel, a lieutenant wrote in his journal. Examining sketches made of the creature by some of the witnesses, researchers say the crew might have seen a whale, rising to the surface to feed. But of course, it's going to be anything other than a monster because, of course, scientists don't believe in monsters. Well, from sea serpents, let's talk about vampires. How about Mercy Brown, the American vampire? It's a long way from the forbidding castles of Transylvania to quaint cottages in New England, but it was in Exeter, Rhode Island in the late 19th century that people became convinced they had a vampire in their midst. Now, in the winter of 1892, a young lady named Mercy Brown died at age 19 during an outbreak of the then incurable affliction people called consumption. It's now known as the lung disease tuberculosis. Anxious villagers came to suspect the Brown family was the cause of the spread of the illness, since Mercy's mother, Mary Eliza, and sister, Mary Olive, had also died, and her brother Edwin had also contracted the disease. Now, nobody used the word, but people feared a vampire lurked in the Brown family. One would be sure was to dig up the bodies. Well, under pressure by the town leaders, the father, George Brown, allowed the exhumation of his family members from their plot in Chestnut Hill Cemetery for inspection by an accepted doctor. Now, Mary Eliza and Mary Olive appeared to be appropriately rotting in their graves, but the second daughter, Mercy, had a most unusual corpse. She had barely decomposed. Her face was flushed. There was still blood in her heart and veins. So, the logical conclusion, she was an undead creature feeding on the innocents in town. And to save her brother and the rest of the village, she had to be killed once and for all. Well, in a macabre ritual that followed the folklore at the time, her liver and heart were burned and the ashes went into a potion given to Edwin to drink. The rest of her body, of course, was set on fire and what was left buried in a new location. Well, in spite of all these precautions, Edwin died anyway. But the townspeople seemed satisfied that they had killed the vampire. Today, researchers attribute the lack of Mercy's decomposition to the fact her corpse had been preserved in the freezing above-ground crypt while awaiting for the ground to thaw enough to bury her. So it does. We're dealing with an instance of coincidence. Was she a vampire? Are there really vampires? Well, let's talk about a werewolf. Gilles Garnier, the French werewolf. He was actually considered a cannibal serial killer. In the French village of Dole, several children mysteriously disappeared and were found dead. This being the 16th century, of course, the citizens assumed that A werewolf was devouring the town's young. Local leaders issued an edict to track down the creature and kill it. Well, one night, a group of men came across what they thought in the darkness was the killer wolf next to a child's corpse. When they got closer, they found it was instead a local eccentric by the name of Giles Garnier, who lived with his new wife just outside the village. Well, he was arrested and put on trial, and he gave a full and stunning confession. He said that while he was hunting in the forest for food, a specter gave him a potion that turned him into a wolf to make it easier to get prey. And in this wolf state, he said, he attacked his first victim, a 10-year-old girl he strangled and feasted upon in a vineyard before bringing some of her flesh home to give to his wife. He later confessed to murdering and devouring at least 3 other children. Witnesses saying he sometimes appeared in human form, sometimes as a loup guru or wolfman. Well, eventually convicted of witchcraft and crimes of lycanthropy, or transforming himself into a wolf, he was burned at the stake in 1574. Although Garnier was a confessed serial killer and cannibal, the idea he was also a werewolf likely arose out of the frenzy of the time when fear of rabies had people seeing werewolves behind every bush. And it does raise a lot of interesting questions. Was he guilty or was he just nuts? Well, from werewolves, let's talk about another long-feared creature of the dark. The zombie. One day in 1980, a man approached Angelina Narcisse as she walked through the village marketplace in Haiti. Claimed to be her brother, Clairview, who had died 18 years before. Now, she didn't believe him, after all. She'd seen him pull the sheet over his head at the hospital where he died. But he convinced her he was who he claimed to be by using his boyhood nickname that only close family members knew. Well, as Angelina asked how this could be, since she knew her her brother had been dead for 18 years, he told a most amazing story. He checked himself into the Albert Schweitzer Hospital on April 30th, 1962, with aches, fever, and malaise. Condition grew worse, and on May 2nd, 2 doctors pronounced him dead. However, he said he was very much alive, hearing everything, but he couldn't talk or move. Felt like his skin was burning. It was in this state he was put in a coffin that was nailed shut and buried. Next thing he knew, the coffin was opened by a voodoo witch known as a Bokor, who had Clairvius beaten in submission and sent to a sugar plantation where for the next year he worked in a dazed state with other zombie-like workers. Well, when some other slaves killed the Bokor, he escaped and wandered the country for 16 years before he came back to his village. Said he waited to return till his brother, who he blamed for putting him into slavery, died. Well, his case has been held up as one of the better documented cases of a zombie. That's a figure rooted in Haitian culture for hundreds of years. Of course, there could be a scientific explanation. One researcher believed he was given a pufferfish poison that paralyzed him, made him look dead, and he's revived with a hallucinogenic from a toad. Well, the theory became the subject of fierce and vitriolic debate, but Clairvius never wavered in his tale until the day he died a second time in 1994. It does make you wonder, are there zombies? Well, we've come to the end of tonight's show. We'll be back tomorrow, once again, when you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great evening.